Du lyssnar på seminariet Vilka tävlar om presidentskapet som arrangerades av Arena Idé den 2 oktober. Medverkare i seminariet gör Jim Arkedis, politisk rådgivare åt Demokraterna, och Karin Henriksson, Svenska Dagbladets fleråriga USA-korrespondent. Bo Rutström modererar samtalet. Vill du höra fler seminarier som Arena Idé arrangerat? Gå in på Arena Play antingen via SoundCloud eller på iTunes.
I feel a little silly. I feel like I'm at the dentist's office with this microphone, but that's okay. First of all, thank you, Boa. Thank you to the Arena Group in general for having me. This is a lot of fun. Also, thank you to Eric Sundström and Emma, where did she go? Olma Beck, right there, who are my good friends. And one of the main reasons that I'm even standing up here in the first place. So thank you, guys. Also, I'm sleeping on their couch this weekend, so that's nice, too. My name is Jim Arkadis. I live in Washington, D.C. I do three things by way of introduction. First, I'm a political consultant. I try and work with, I love American politics. I love American foreign policy. And so together, that means that I work with a lot of international groups who are trying to learn about American politics and how to communicate and talk and things like that. Second, I run a small political organization in Washington, D.C., and basically, by way of full disclosure, I'm a Democrat. Everything I say here is from the Democratic perspective, but I will be very harsh on parts of the Democratic Party along the way, so that's fun. My organization works with Democrats, Democratic candidates for House and Senate, mainly, and we try and help them talk about mostly U.S. foreign policy and national security issues. So it's taking policy and helping translate it into political language. And then the last thing is, by way of really big self-promotion, I wrote this book, or co-authored this book. It's called Political Mercenaries. It came out almost exactly 1 year ago, and it's about, it's the story of how money started to explode in American politics, when it went from nothing 20, 25 years ago to becoming the all-consuming monster that it is today. So over the course of this lecture, we're going to talk about three things: the general context for the 2016 presidential election. Then I will give a brief overview of the Republican side, and then the Democratic side, and make predictions along the way. And we will all get to watch a lot of funny videos about Donald Trump. I just realized I am not connected to the internet. Oh, wait, I might be. I think they did it do that automatically for me? Okay, so we're connected to the internet. That's good. Okay, so let's get started. Okay, so in general, and I think this is definitely true in American political elections, but also in elections probably throughout the world, there are two kinds of elections. They're what I call a continuity election and what I call a change election. And here, because mainly I didn't have enough room to do more than this, here are the last several American political elections. For continuity elections, it's basically the party has been in power, things are going okay, and the question is, from the standpoint of going okay, should we basically continue along the same path? Then there are change elections, which are something has gone horribly wrong and we need a drastic change. This is how we end up electing an African American to become president of the United States, right? It does not happen very easily or often. I put an asterisk by 2000 because this was basically a continuity election. Bill Clinton was the president of the United States. He had had two successful terms. It was nominally a referendum on how Bill Clinton was doing. The whole frame and start of that election should have been, you know, we've been successful. Let's continue that, right? However, Al Gore, the Democratic nominee, was not the best candidate. And the Republicans were so sick of Bill Clinton that they did everything possible, money, power, sort of organization, to try and get George Bush elected. Of course, it was a very close election, and it came down to basically Al Gore getting more votes than George Bush, but George Bush still won the election. I think that this is kind of where we are today, right? We will probably have a flawed Democratic nominee in a continuity election, fighting against a Republican Party that will do everything possible to win in a way that they maybe didn't with John McCain in 2008 or with Mitt Romney in 2012. So since World War II, there have basically been two presidential eras in the United States. I'll take a step back. What might we call these eras? Let's look at this side. This is basically the progressive era, where we have FDR, three times Truman, interrupted briefly by a Republican Eisenhower, and then Kennedy, and then Lyndon Baines Johnson, right? Of course, over here, we have the conservative era. Nixon, followed by Ford, who was Nixon's replacement, interrupted briefly by Carter, principally as a result of Nixon's corruption. Reagan, Bush Sr., Bill Clinton was the most exceptional candidate and politician probably of our generation in the last 60 or 70 years. And then, of course, George W. Bush. Let's think about what changed these eras, right? What happened here? Vietnam, and one other thing, civil rights legislation. LBJ's quote at the time, aside from Vietnam, was, "I've lost the South for a generation." Politically, that's true. The South of the United States used to be a Democratic stronghold. Today it is a Republican conservative stronghold. So basically, combined with the war, things got more progressive, and then he overreached. He went a little bit too far for where the country was, right? And that made a change. Eisenhower, of course, was a war hero and had a very compelling biography, so that's why he was allowed to be elected. In the conservative era, Nixon was basically a moderate Republican, right? And then the Republicans get more and more conservative throughout the era. Carter, of course, got in mainly because Nixon resigned and the country was sort of sick of that. But then we went back to a very conservative time for 12 full years. Bill Clinton got his way in because in 92 the vote was split with Ross Perot and he was an amazing candidate. Yeah. And then with George W. Bush, we continue the conservative era, but of course there's an overreach here. He goes too far with the Iraq War. And the country says, nope, we've had enough of this. It's time to change. So I would argue that today, starting with the presidential administration of Barack Obama, we are basically entering an era, a new progressive era of American presidential politics, where the demographics of the country in terms of young people, Latinos, immigrants, the party's positions on various issues, including gay rights, youth, servicing the youth, like with student loans, how young people have already voted for Barack Obama, population shifts within swing states, Florida, Virginia, Colorado, Ohio, all of them are trending more Latino, for example. All of them have been previously conservative states, red states that are beginning to move into the purple arena. So all of these things help set up the fact that we are at the dawn, more or less, of a new progressive era in politics. And I would argue that probably over the next 7 elections, give or take, we will see a majority of Democrats elected. Not all, but out of 7, the next 7 elections, say 5 Democrats will probably win, depending on if there are very specific circumstances surrounding each election, or there are very compelling candidates that run. So let's set the context for this specific election. There are a lot of numbers up here. Right track, wrong track. Every month, more or less, pollsters in the United States go out and say, do you, voter, think that the country is going in the right direction or the wrong direction? This is not a good result if you're an incumbent, right? 25% of the country says that we are on the wrong direction. That's horrible. I'm sorry, 25% says we're in the right direction. That is horrible, right? By context, at this same point in 2012, 40% of the country said that we were going in the right direction. That is a very compelling and important number, the 40%. It is usually below 40% when incumbents in the United States begin to experience real difficulty getting reelected. So you don't want to be before 40%. Now, in general, Barack Obama, as a politician, is liked pretty well. He's an incumbent who's been in power for 7 years, more or less, and he's got a 46% approval rating. That's not bad. George W. Bush in 2008 had a 25% approval rating at this same stage in the election, right? The other important statistic is congressional approval rating. 15% of the country approves of Congress. If you can help me find those 15%, we are doing a good job and it'll take a long time, right? Everybody hates Congress. Everybody hates Congress. Most of you probably know this, but who controls both houses of Congress? The Republican Party, right? So, all of these things combine with one other very important statistic, and that's this one. The economy is always, when you go out and ask people which is the most important issue, the economy is always, always, always the most important issue. The second most important issue to voters across the United States is shocking. Dissatisfaction with their government. Almost one in five Americans said the top issue they care about is that they hate their government. That is amazing. That has never happened, right? We have other important substantive issues like immigration, foreign policy. That's even a little higher than it should be. Normally, it's around 4 or 5%. Here, we're almost double. And when candidates talk about foreign policy, people are really evaluating them not on what their policies are, what we should do with China, what we should do with Russia, whatever, et cetera, but how good of a leader are you? So that's why that's a very important one. And then race relations is also pretty high for the first time ever because we've had all of these horrible and unfortunate killings in Ferguson, Missouri, near St. Louis, and in Baltimore. And so that's really in the public's mind. And then healthcare, these are all Republicans who hate Obamacare. I am on Obamacare. It works. It's okay. So let's go back to the top number. 25% of the country say it's on the right track. And understanding that traditionally, 40% is the threshold under which the incumbent should be nervous. I also just told you that we are probably at the dawn of a progressive era and that this is a continuity election. So something's not right, right? I explain the 25% number by saying when this is the second most important issue for the first time ever, and understanding that Congress, that is controlled by Republicans, has a 15% approval rating, that this right track, wrong track number is shared across both parties. Everyone is to blame. It's not just the president. So I think that we are in a unique situation where despite the fact that only 25% of the country approves of its direction, it is still a continuity election that should, in its larger frame, set up well for the Democratic nominee, whoever that is. Just one quick slide on how this works mechanically. I'm sure most of you are very familiar, so I'll just explain very, very fast. Basically, there are several primaries in order. First is Iowa, next is New Hampshire, next is South Carolina. Then we get to Super Tuesday, where there are many, many primaries, the first round of elections. The period we're in now is called the invisible primary, where people are courting donors and trying to get in media, right? So that's actually a new phenomenon. And then, of course, the general election is not one national election. It is 50 separate elections. Really, there are only about 9 elections in the various swing states that really matter. So that's just to make sure And then one quick word on the role of the super PACs, which is really important. Super PACs were blessed by the Citizens United Supreme Court ruling in 2010. They are independent organizations that are completely separate from campaigns. They can do whatever they want. They can accept unlimited money. The only thing that they cannot do is to coordinate officially with a campaign, but there are lots of funny ways around that. For example, a super PAC can pay a lot of money and have a poll done. They cannot take the poll, the results of the poll, and then go to the presidential candidate and says, here's what we found. But they can, for example, call up a reporter at the New York Times and say, oh, we just did this poll. Here's some interesting numbers that the New York Times prints, and of course, the campaign is allowed to see. Second, a candidate for office can come into a meeting like this, a fundraiser, and say, gosh, I really love this super PAC. Good night. And leave. And then everybody gives money to the super PAC. It's really, really terrible. Super PACs are the organizations over the last several cycles that have started to take on the role of doing the dirty work, of doing the attack ads, of saying the nastiest things, because they can say whatever they want to and then fold up and disappear and nobody knows who they are the next day. So that's basically the context. I will turn it over to Karin for any...
Well, it's great to be here. As Jim said, it's really an honor. Anyway, I was just going to say a couple of things. And first of all, the question I often get from people that I meet in Swedes, I mean, is why is America so polarized?
Yep.
And that is obviously part of the whole primary season. event that we're now going to see pretty soon. So that is one important thing to remember, that in the primaries, the party extremists are the ones that are really out and about, and that's why maybe we could actually state that that's why the candidates, particularly on the Republican side, have been so conservative these last few years. That's one point. And another point I would say is, so where is the starting point for when you decide whether it's a progressive or a continuation era? So with Bill Clinton, so he was, as you pointed out in your table there, he was kind of forced to continue on the Reagan era in a way. End welfare as we know it. Mm-hmm. So that is the other question. Where are we now? And that's going to be very exciting for the next year for us journalists, to when we're supposed to start summarize Barack Obama's presidency. Has he been progressive the way he was supposed to be, if you listen to his rhetoric, or has he just been stopped by the Republicans in Congress? So what else would I say? Let's see. Yeah, and then I personally, and that's what I write about a little bit in my Reagan book, is the hate against the government, hate against government. Mm-hmm. I personally think that that is very dangerous and disruptive and bad for America, that those sentiments exist, and that is again going to be a very important issue in all the elections, particularly from the Republican candidates.
Yeah. Very briefly, I would just say that on the hatred of government, I mean, this is a problem. This is a cultural aspect of the United States that goes back to the very founding of the Republic.
Right? Yes, but I mean, you could also say during the Roosevelt era, that was what saved America from from the Depression, etc.
Right. There are, of course, shifts back and forth, but when there is an underlying strain of hatred that today's Republican Party seizes on, they are really tapping into something that is long in the back of the brain of every American, how we sort of distrust the government, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So there's that. I mean, that is never going to change. I mean, that would take millennia to change.
Yes. But, I mean, you could say that Democrats kind of tried to clean up after Republican administrations, like something like FEMA that did not work during it worked greatly under Bill Clinton, and then it worked not so good under George Bush, and now it's back to being a very efficient organization.
FEMA is the organization that, after the hurricane in New Orleans, was supposed to clean up federal emergency management.
Yeah, so anyway, I'm just saying that however hard Democrats try to put in very good people in all agencies, it still doesn't sort of convince Americans that the government can work for you, and therefore maybe you should pay a little taxes. That the way the Swedes do, you know.
I would just say one more thing. On the progressive era, it starts when the previous party goes too far, like George Bush did in Iraq, for example. The first person to come in from the other party, but almost by definition, has to be more moderate, right?
Right.
Because that is the general context. The country is just getting used to this change. And so Barack Obama offered this amazing rhetoric and gave all these great speeches, but when he governed, he basically governed as a centrist, right?
Right.
As did Bill Clinton, because interrupting a conservative era is not going to be done by some crazy liberal. It's going to be done by the Democrat who is acceptable to the other side, right?
Yeah. Just one more point, and that is, it's going to be very exciting too, the congressional election next year. Mm-hmm. Whether to see if the voters will really punish this Republican majority, because they did promise that they would get things done, there would be an amazing amount of legislation passed, and that hasn't happened. And I would assume that their base is very angry, the really conservative guys, and then also everybody else. So that's even their own are angry.
Yeah.
Okay, next. Are we doing next section?
Yep, we're going. So let's talk about the Republican primary. As a general party as a whole, of course, they have adopted a strategy since 2008 that everything that Barack Obama does is wrong. Barack Obama could go outside and say the sky is blue today, and they would say, no, it's green, right? Mitch McConnell, who is the Republican leader of the Senate, the majority leader in the Senate, because Republicans have the majority, said in about 2010, 2011, that his only goal, his top goal, was to make sure that Barack Obama was a one-term president, right? His goal was not to lead the country. His goal was not to pass legislation. His goal was not to represent the people of Kentucky who had elected him. His goal was to defeat the guy who's in the White House. And so we talk about, you know, hatred of government. This is a fundamental difference kind of between most Democrats and most Republicans, where Republicans make it about hating the person. They hate Barack Obama with all of their heart and all of their soul, right? They hated Bill Clinton with all of their heart and all of their soul, right? I thought George Bush was a terrible president, but like I'd hang out with him, you know? So it's a difference about policy. It's a difference about governance style as opposed to visceral personal hatred that Republicans do a much better job of making about the president, about the person in power. After the 2012 election, the Republican leadership at the Republican National Committee issued a report. And they said, hey, guys, if we're ever going to win this election, this presidential election again, we should not hate Hispanic voters so much. We should be nicer to gays. We should be better to women. And everybody kind of said, oh, yeah, that's the direction the Republican Party should go to, should go in. And then everybody running for office, even starting in 2014, basically ignored it. Right. And then we have Donald Trump, who's torn it up and thrown it out the window. Right. This is not a Republican Party that's in the mood to move to the center, even though their leadership says that they should. And that is a comment on the strength of the Republican Party's leadership in general and the RNC, the National Committee. It's not very strong because they can't force this change down their candidates' throats. So a lot of these Republican candidates are running these very hard change campaigns in a year that sets up more as a continuity year, right? That's going to be very tough in the general election. Then, of course, we have the Trump effect. In 2012, Mitt Romney had a real problem. He got torn to the right really hard on a lot of issues. He had a big trouble coming back to the center in the general election because he couldn't moderate his stances that he had to take in the primary on things like immigration to be appealing to the middle of the country in the general election, right? And then we have so many Republicans running today because there is no disincentive to run. I might as well declare to be a Republican candidate for president because I'll get on TV. I'll maybe get to sell a couple books. You know, maybe I'll get a TV show when it's all done. I'll get people to pay me to speak. You know, I'm not getting paid here for the record. And that's okay. But it's all like that's why people think that they should run for president. There is no disincentive to running. And then last, another comment on how weak the Republican National Party is. They tried to put through a bunch of changes to shorten the primary season in 2016. Move all the primaries up. Let's decide this nominee as quickly as they can. It's not working, right? It's not working. Super PACs have an amazing ability to keep candidates in the race longer than they should. The best example is Rick Santorum. Rick Santorum is a senator, former senator from Pennsylvania. He is an evangelical. He is never going to be elected president. But he found some guy named Foster Friess to give him $5 million in a super PAC. And so Rick Santorum was the last guy standing against Mitt Romney in 2012. That's crazy. It should never happen. But here we are. So let's understand the Republicans in general and how the Republican Party works. Think of the Republican Party basically like a highway where there are three lanes in the road. Okay? Traditionally, the business establishment moderate wing of the party has been the largest lane in the highway. The evangelical wing, that's the Christian wing, hardcore social conservatives, have always had a substantial presence, right? But a little bit smaller, but always existing, is the libertarian Tea Party wing. So that's how we traditionally look at the Republican Party. We say that Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line. Oh, this Obama guy is great. Yeah, let hope and change. Let's vote for him, right? And they say, nope, Bob Dole is going to be our nominee this year. right? Possibly the most uninspiring candidate ever in the history of American politics. I'll only call about three or four other people the most uninspiring candidate in the history of American politics throughout this lecture. But that's how we get John McCain. That's how we get Mitt Romney. That's how we get Bob Dole. That's how we get George Bush Sr. The establishment has said, this is the person we're going to have as our nominee, and we're going to force that person through, right? This person always has to be acceptable to the evangelical wing. The evangelicals have never had really a champion nominee except maybe Barry Goldwater in the 60s. The establishment person has to be acceptable to the evangelical Christians. Why? Because evangelicals are the door knockers. They're the people who make the phone calls. They are the backbone of the party, right? In the way that unions are for the Democrats. So Mitt Romney in 2012, the evangelicals hated him because he was a gay-loving Mormon from Massachusetts. So there was a lack of enthusiasm there. They didn't want to go knock on doors for him. They didn't want to make phone calls. Like, this was a turnout problem for Romney, right? They've tried their best to kind of ignore the crazy people in the Tea Party. It almost has not worked, maybe until now. The central question this year in the Republican Party is, how are these lanes in the road shifting in size? We don't know yet. And I couldn't tell you the answer. But we know that they probably are. The Tea Party wing has been in the ascendancy. It's much bigger now. The Republican middle business part has been going down a little bit. This is the fight that will take place over the course of the next several months. And the result of the primary will tell us how big these various lanes in the road are. Some people, Ted Cruz is a great example. I'll talk more about Ted Cruz in a minute. Some people are trying to occupy more than one lane in the road. That's a strategy. Ted Cruz is a libertarian Tea Party hero. He's a senator from Texas, first-term senator from Texas. He is either crazy or a genius. I can't tell which, right? He is either running to be president of the United States or he's running to have a TV show on Fox News. But he's a Tea Party guy, and he made his announcement speech when he was running for president at Liberty University in Virginia. Liberty University is the most evangelical Christian university in the country. He talked all about God and all about his faith. He's gambling that these two lanes in the road are now bigger than this one, right? And so you'll see candidates start to maneuver to do that over the course of the coming months. So here's where we are. Your winner today is Donald Trump. Nationally, he's polling at 24.3%. Ben Carson, an African-American neurosurgeon who has no political experience whatsoever, is second. Carly Fiorina, a woman who ran a failed Senate candidate in California in 2010. And who ran a computer company into the ground and got $25 million for it, is third. Marco Rubio, senator from Florida. Jeb Bush is hovering at 9% nationally. That's nuts, right? Then wacky Ted Cruz and John Kasich. He's the guy to keep an eye on, I think, actually. And I'll talk more about all these folks in a second. This is, okay, so there are national polls that are, of course, important, but really what we care about in the short term are state-based polls. This is for the Iowa caucus. This is the first primary. If the election were held today, and I should remind everybody that I am making all of these predictions and stuff based on what we know right now. I could wake up tomorrow morning, politics could change completely, and we'd have to reevaluate everything. So take this with a grain of salt. This is what we know right now. Iowa caucus, if it were held today, Donald Trump would be your winner at 27.3%. Ben Carson is at 21.3. Ted Cruz, look at this gap, right? Then we have Ted Cruz, Carly Fiorina, everybody else. Jeb Bush is down here at 5%. The third primary, I skipped New Hampshire for some reason. The third primary is South Carolina. Same winners. So let's talk about these folks. I chose a lot of funny pictures, except for Hillary Clinton, because she's the person I back. So one thing to note, I put this on here for a reason. His slogan is Make America Great Again, right? If you want, I said this to Eric last night, if you want the political souvenir of 2016, go on Amazon.com right now and buy a Make America Great Again baseball hat. So Make America Great Again is, think about that slogan. It's a change slogan, right? It's not that far away from hope and change. he's running a change campaign in a continuity election. Of course, any Republican would. But the subtlety of how you message that is also very important. Look, Donald Trump is running a campaign that we have never seen before. He has completely rewritten all of the rules about how you campaign for president of the United States. It is fascinating to watch, and it will be over soon. One of the main things is he's trying to run a real campaign. It's not just all media. He is actually hiring operatives to be on the ground, to get out and knock on doors, to do strategy, to try and get local endorsements, which is very difficult. The success with which he has doing that will determine how successful he is. I think that any Republican worth their salt who's good at what they do is probably loves and hates the idea of working for Donald Trump because they think they'll make a lot of money in the short term, but that he's going to do something and flame out of the campaign sooner rather than later. His appeal across the board is to basically lower middle class white people in the South. They watch Fox News, and they finally found a guy who's willing to say whatever he wants. Dissatisfaction with the country, wrong track, lack of political correctness. They look at Donald Trump, and even if they disagree with him on some of the issues, he says, for example, that hedge fund managers should be taxed more, right? The Republican establishment hates him because he says things like that. That is the business way. That is that biggest lane in the road that he's attacking. He's saying that these people should pay more in taxes. That is like the most antithetical Republican message you could ever have. Pay more in taxes. Like a Republican is saying that. Yet he's leading in the polls because there is this majority, and he uses the term silent majority, which is a dangerous term, to talk about, and I think he did it accidentally at first, and he didn't know what he was referencing. But he talks about that there are all these people sitting in their basements who are so sick of politics, and he's going to say whatever he wants. And when he makes offensive comments about Mexicans or about John McCain or about women or anything, he says, and I'll show you the video clip right now, he says, I don't have time to be politically correct. And they love it. That's his appeal, right? He is also very likely benefiting from name recognition. At this point in the race, when a pollster calls up and says, who are you voting, or which one of the following candidates are you voting for? You know, somebody you've never heard of, another person you've never heard of, another person you've never heard of, Donald Trump, who everybody knows, 92% of the country knows Donald Trump, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Sure. Yeah, the Trump guy, he's the guy I know. He's said obnoxious things. He's been in the media, right? He is very likely benefiting from that. It probably will not last as people become more familiar with the other candidates and start to focus on the election. He has a 66% very favorable rating from very conservative people. Here is one of the most fascinating statistics. Donald Trump has been divorced 3 times, has never read the Bible, and says he never asked God for forgiveness. Yet he has the highest rating among evangelical voters. Like, that is bonkers. That is absolutely crazy. It suggests that those voters care much more about the fact that they hate government than they do about God, right? So he obviously has some weaknesses, many weaknesses. Like he is liable to fly off the handle. He is liable to wake up one morning and see the polls aren't quite as good as they once were and just decide that he's going to get out of the race. He also has this problem where he's a self-financer. He gives all of the money to his campaign. I would not be surprised if an enterprising, smart journalist puts it together that there's been some sort of questionable transfer of money between his own account and his campaign account or something. There is something out there that is going to take Donald Trump down, and it's probably Donald Trump. Okay? Again, he's aiming for the South, Iowa and New Hampshire. As long as he doesn't implode and decide that he can't, that he's just sick of the whole thing and he wants to go home and he's had his fun, he will probably get through South Carolina, right? If he loses South Carolina, my guess is he'll get out after South Carolina. If he wins, it's going to be a longer, uglier race, right? The press is going to start to pay more attention to him, and others are finally starting to go after him. So let's see if we can watch some videos here. I forget kind of which order these are in, so bear with me. I've also tried to select videos that... Oh, no, it's thinking. Nope, here we go.
They wanted me to do her show, and I know it's a good show, but...
The only thing constant is Trump.
But I knew it was going to be a big crowd because I get big crowds. I get ratings.
They call me the ratings machine.
They wanted me to do her show, and I know it's good showbiz. I know it's good for ratings.
Somebody said I'm the most popular person in Arizona because of my stance. Look, my life has been an interesting life. I've had a lot of fun. I'm leading in the polls. I go on your show. You will get the highest ratings you've had in years. I mean, it's one of those things, assuming people know I'm on it.
You're and number two. Why do people respond to you one. So much?
All of them change on the bottom. They're going up and down like yo-yo. But I've been up there for a long time, and I hope I'm going to be up there for a long time.
So there's one. Let's see if we can find a couple other funny ones. Here's his announcement.
The U.S. has become a dumping ground for everybody else's problems. Thank you. It's true. And these are the best and the finest. When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people. But I speak to border guards, and they tell.
So that's amazing, right? Okay, here is one, I think. This is Trump.
Mr. Trump, one of the things people love about you is you speak your mind and you don't use a politician's filter. However, that is not without its downsides, in particular when it comes to women. You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Your Twitter account
only
is
Rosie
several...
O'Donnell.
No, it wasn't. Your Twitter account.
Thank you.
For the record, it was well beyond Rosie O'Donnell.
Yes,
like,
I'm
good
sure
for her.
Your
right?
Twitter account has several disparaging comments about women's looks. You once told a contestant on Celebrity Apprentice it would be a pretty picture to see her on her knees. Does that sound to you like the temperament of a man we should elect as president?
How will you answer the charge from
Hillary Clinton, who is likely to be the Democratic nominee, that you are part of the war on women?
I think the big problem this country has is being politically correct. I've been...
Dissatisfaction with government.
I've been challenged by so many people, and I don't frankly have time for total political correctness. And to be honest with you, this country doesn't have time either. This country is in big trouble. We don't win anymore. We lose to China. We lose to Mexico, both in trade and at the border. We lose to everybody. And frankly, what I say, and oftentimes it's fun, it's kidding, we have a good time, what I say is what I say. And honestly, Megan, if you don't like it, I'm sorry. I've been very nice to you, although I could probably maybe not be based on the way you have treated me, but I wouldn't do that. But you know what?
So anyway, yeah, so that's the thing. Here's one more fun one, just because it's fun.
Because I don't need anybody's money. It's nice. I don't need anybody's money. I'm using my own money. I'm not using the lobbyists. I'm not using donors. I don't care. I'm really rich. I'll show you that in a second. And by the way, I'm not even saying that in a bragging. That's the kind of mindset, that's the kind of thinking you need for this country.
Right? Like, that's what we need. We need a rich guy. Finally. Okay, so that's Donald Trump. We'll move on. I'll do the rest of these pretty quickly because only one or two more.
Well, let's bring in Gina Loudon. She's a conservative columnist out in San Diego. Gina, you know, you follow Donald Trump closely. I follow your tweets closely.
So Ben Carson is an African-American neurosurgeon. He's never held political offices in his entire life. His claim to fame is that he's at Johns Hopkins University, and he was the first person on the face of the earth to separate Siamese twins who'd been joined. He has written a book. He has become a hero amongst Tea Party, Libertarian, and the evangelical crowd. He's another guy trying to occupy both lanes in the road. He's never going to win the nomination. Or if he does, like, I'll eat my iPhone. He's basically running so he can be the Surgeon General in a Republican administration. And he's doing this because he wants to raise his profile. Here's something obnoxious. that Ben Carson said.
Let me wrap this up by finally dealing with what's been going on, Donald Trump, and a deal with a questioner that that claimed that the president was Muslim. Let me ask you the question this way. Should a president's faith matter? Should your faith matter to voters?
Well, I guess it depends on what that faith is. If it's inconsistent with the values and principles of America, then of course it should matter. But if it fits within the realm of America and consistent with the Constitution, no problem.
So do you believe that Islam is consistent with the Constitution?
No, I don't. I do not. I would not advocate that we put a Muslim in charge of this nation. I absolutely would not agree with that.
And you.
So that's Ben Carson in a nutshell. He's not very exciting. He's not very charismatic. In a very cold, hard analysis type of a way, I honestly think that a lot of his popularity is because he's African-American. It is very easy to be in the Republican Party today and be a black guy and get popular because they're all trying to think, we have all these race problems, let's support somebody who's black to show that we're not a bunch of racists. Like that is a real, and I've said that to Republicans before, and they basically agree with me. Okay, so here's Marco Rubio. We'll show one funny video from him. He's a young guy. He's a Latino. He tried for a while to pass a Republican-led immigration bill. He's doing okay. He's raised $12 million, which is exactly 5% of what Jeb Bush has raised up to this point. You know, his basic strategy is like to hang around as long as possible and see if the race shakes out in a way that might get him a path to victory. There isn't one there for him yet, right? He also is a current senator from the state of Florida. The state of Florida has a law that says you are not allowed to run for two offices consecutively. So he's running for president. He's filed his papers for president. His Senate seat is up for re-election next November. I wouldn't be surprised if he runs for president for as long as possible to raise his profile in the national media, and then 2 days before the last day that he can file to run for Senate, jumps back to his old Senate seat. This is probably the most heartfelt, horrible thing I've ever seen to a public official ever. This is Marco Rubio giving a response to
on foreign policy. America continues to be indispensable to the glow of global liberty.
This is his debut
property
on the
safeguarding human rights.
Years ago.
The world is a better place when America is the strongest nation on earth. But we can't remain powerful if we don't have an economy that can afford it. In the short time that I've been here in Washington, nothing has frustrated me more than false choices like the one the president laid out tonight. The choice isn't just between big government or big business.
You feel bad for the guy, but anyway. So here's Carly Fiorina. She had a wonderful debate the other night. She challenged Donald Trump. I'll show you that clip. She is the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard. It's a massive, you know, computing and printer firm. She tells this great story about how she was the CEO and how she helped save 80,000 jobs and led the company through difficult times, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Basically, her term as CEO was a disaster. She was the one who advocated for a merger with Compaq Computers. It did not go very well. Everybody hated her at the company. She ended up getting fired, and they paid her off with $25 million. She ran a lackluster campaign for Senate in California in 2010. She didn't do well. She is like the latest media fascination when the media is searching for somebody who they could put as the anti-Trump, right? I think she's running to be vice president. If Hillary Clinton is the Democratic nominee, which I think is likely, the Republicans almost have to put a woman on the ticket. It would be really bad, I think, for the Republican Party if they did not put a woman on the ticket. So here's her going after Donald Trump. Hopefully this loads. So Donald Trump had this remark where he said, oh, I look at Carly Fiorina's face, and I think that woman
cannot be president. You know, it's interesting to me, Mr. Trump said that he heard Mr. Bush. You know, it's interesting to me, Mr. Trump said that he heard Mr. Bush very clearly and what Mr. Bush said. I think women all over this country heard very clearly what Mr. Trump said.
Right, so she went after Trump. The standard response to Trump and why the entire party has been moved to the right is because nobody's challenged him on anything. He said that Mexicans were rapists, right? And every your response in politics, you have three choices for a response in politics. You can challenge somebody, you can agree with them, or you can shut up. The vast majority of the Republican Party is not saying anything. This is yanking the entire party to the right. This is going to make it much more difficult for them to come back to the middle, whoever the nominee is, whether it's Jeb Bush or anybody else, because Jeb Bush was basically silent. That is the difficulty. She, in that clip, was the first person to actually challenge Donald Trump on anything. And the only reason she could do it is because she's a woman and she has that authority. But this speaks to the heart of the problem within the Republican Party. And now my computer is deciding that it's going to think about things for a while. Okay. So Jeb Bush, while it thinks, I just restarted it too to avoid this problem. Jeb Bush is the next guy up. He has basically raised a gajillion dollars. He's raised $120 million for a super PAC. He's raised $120 million for his own campaign. He is going to have no problem with money. However, he has sort of turned into a lackluster candidate. He's not been in office since 2008. He's had a real problem responding to substantive questions. He said on the campaign trail the other day, several weeks ago, that somebody asked him, if you knew what we know now, would you still have gone into Iraq? And his question and his answer was, yeah. I don't care who you are, what office you're running for, if you're conservative or progressive or whatever. The answer to that question is not yes. Right? Normally, when you misspeak, like when you say the wrong thing, you answer incorrectly, never have a 2.5-year-old computer. So when you misspeak like that, basically you issue a correction within a couple hours or a day. It took his campaign an entire week to issue a correction, right? That's a real problem for him. He basically is the person who occupies that Republican lane in the road, that Republican moderate business lane in the road. He has a big problem because his name is Bush, but everything else he's got working for him. Like, I don't think the country would go to hell under Jeb the way that it did under George. I think Jeb Bush is a smarter, genuinely speaking, more articulate guy. However, the Republican establishment is going to get very nervous with him if he's not able to correct a lot of these problems, right? So I think basically what you may see, I don't want to take up all the time here and turn it over to Karen, but still nothing. I think what you may see, I'll skip over Ted Cruz because I already talked about him, but I think what you might see is kind of a freak out amongst the Republican establishment if Jeb Bush continues to have problems. They are going to say, this guy has all the money in the world. He's got everything going for him. His name's Bush, so we're not confident about that. But at the end of the day, he should be pretty good, and we don't understand why he's not. The next logical choice when they're going to look for somebody who looks like Jeb Bush, who doesn't have the Jeb Bush name, is a guy by the name of John Kasich. He is the governor of Ohio. Hey, okay, let's try this again. He's the governor of Ohio. He's been in Congress for 18 years. He's been the governor of Ohio for the last 5 years. He's well-spoken, he's articulate, he's not terribly exciting, but he was on the Armed Services Committee in the House of Representatives. He understands the military. He tells this very compelling story about how he gets the economy, how he gets the legislative process, how he understands the military, how he understands national defense. And he's the guy to lead the country. And basically, he just talks from a standpoint of biography right now. He doesn't say anything about policy positions very much, but if he can figure out a way to hang around, there we go. If he can figure out a way to hang around for a little bit, and Jeb Bush falters, this guy is my dark horse candidate to be the Republican nominee. You heard it here first. There is no, like, political punditry is easy, right? Because I can say this and there are no consequences for me for getting it wrong. But there is definitely a pathway for John Kasich to become the nominee. The political prediction markets, where you pay money and essentially bet on candidates, still have today 24% that Jeb Bush is the most likely guy to be the Republican nominee out of all of this, right? But watch John Kasich and see what he does. Then last is the rest of the field, a bunch of people who are never going to win, who you don't care about, who I'm not going to talk about. This is a picture of Rick Santorum, the former senator from Pennsylvania. I took this picture on a plane that we were on a plane together right? This is what happens when you're a fourth tier Republican candidate for president. You're forced to wait around for planes that I'm on. Anyway, with that, I turn it over to Karen for...
Actually, I stood next to Rick Santorum also. He was so desperate to talk to some journalists.
Yeah,
he even
sure.
talked to Swedes.
How many voters, how many Americans live in Stockholm?
Yeah, right. And I wanted to ask him, so what will the issues be? But he didn't want to talk about issues. He just wanted to talk about the so-called horse race where we yep. are right now. Who's up, who's down? And that's when politics becomes like a contest or a game. And a lot of the American presidential yep. politics is really that. But anyway, just to basically say what Jim said, that is, to be the Republican Party establishment must be very difficult, because it started out very well. They had a president that all their voters hate, whom they think is a complete failure, and then they had what they still say, a great field. We have many experienced governors that have won elections in Democratic states. And we have also sitting senators who are high-profile senators who have been succeeding to become sort of big names in a very short time. And here we are.
Yeah.
And I also went to a meeting at the Republican National Committee headquarters where they outlined one of these reports that Jim mentioned. How are we going to attract minority voters and Latino voters and women voters? And that's like 3 years ago, and nothing has happened. But there, I think it's important to remember that from a Democratic standpoint, this has been said for at least 10 years, that the Republicans are doomed because demographically, because they don't have the support from future bigger and bigger voter groups. But we're not there quite yet, and it also depends on the states, who's strongest in which states. So I think that there will be a temptation in a country like Sweden to imagine that the Republicans don't have a chance next year's election, but I think they still might because of the system. I mean, who won in 2000 if we had a parliamentarian system? And also another thing, that Americans sometimes think that a businessman would be the right choice to run the country. We saw that with Ross Perot in 1992, and that's part of, I think, Trump's appeal. And then, obviously, that he's rich, he's been successful, he's a celebrity. And I also think that he's not quite as stupid as maybe people would think he is.
Oh, I don't think he's stupid
no.
at all.
No, but a lot of people do. They think that he's just outrageous.
He knows exactly what he's doing.
Yeah, and yeah. he actually does manage to put the finger right on to various important issues in society. So I think that that's a big part of his appeal. And then it's the other thing, I mean, they hate government, but they also hate the elites,
sure.
right? And the Clintons kind of are a super elite even.
Yeah.
And then Ben Carson, yeah, let's just hope that he disappears soon. And and when it comes to Trump, I've said what you have said, even in my article, said he's going to decide one day he can't be with these losers. I'm out of here. What is this? And also, I don't think that he's willing to spend all these hundreds of millions of dollars.
I think that's right. I think he will start to get nervous about how much money he has to spend.
And yeah, maybe we have to go on to the Democrats.
Okay. I will say, so we've said in not so many words something that Eric and I were talking about last night, and his analysis of populist candidates like Trump. They basically do a couple things. They identify a problem, right? And then they say that the people up there don't understand it, and I'm going to protect you from whatever the problem is, right? And so that's what he's done with immigration. Okay, let's hopefully move on to the Democrats, maybe. Oh, my gosh, this is the first time this has happened all week. I've given this lecture three times. Anyway, okay, it's going to think. Basically, here's where we are with the Democratic primary. Oh, good. Okay, Hillary Clinton. This is a national poll. She's up by 13 points, more or less, over Bernie Sanders. They've included Joe Biden in this polling, which is got a little excited. Okay, they've included Joe Biden in this polling. It's not, sir. I'm shocked that Joe Biden has not made an announcement one way or the other about whether he's going to run up to this point. I guess if Joe Biden were not in this poll, that Hillary would probably be a little bit farther ahead, but there's definitely some support from Biden going Bernie Sanders' way. You know, the Democratic Party basically has everything possibly going for it in terms of demographics and logistics and things like that. That's why I can say more confidently the beginning of the progressive era is more or less on us. You know, they've occupied the center ground more. The election should tilt in our favor because we have a stronger coalition of young folks and environmentalists and minorities and Latinos and gay people and whatever. This is a benefit and a curse on the Democratic Party. We are a basic coalition of special interests. There is no unifying idea that unites the Democratic Party like it there did 20, 30, 40 years ago. Then it was about the middle class. How do you send your kids to college? How do you buy a house? How do you get a good job? How do you get a good pension, right? Now it's, we love gay people and we love Latinos and we love young people and we love environmentalists. There is no cohesive policy that unites all of those things. That might win us an election. That might get us to 50 plus 1%, but it's going to be a real problem going forward. Here are hopefully some Iowa polls. Basically that say, there we go, the candidates are more or less tied, which does not bode particularly well for Hillary Clinton. Like, that's the first caucus, and Hillary Clinton's hanging around with, like, 5% advantage, probably within the margin of error, Bernie Sanders. Here is where it gets a little bit more funny. She's down in South Carolina, right? Those are real. I don't know why I didn't include New Hampshire, and I apologize for that, but basically, it tells the story that Hillary Clinton should be in a very dominant position because of the national polls. But when you get down into the states, not so much. Okay, Hillary Clinton is my pick. Like, I think Hillary Clinton is, I want to support her to be president. I agree with her 98% on policy. I think it would be very, very good for the United States to have a woman as president. That said, the next 3 or 4 minutes, I'm going to completely tear Hillary Clinton apart. It is going to be a major, major challenge for her to win the presidency. There is no doubt about it. Anybody who thinks, oh, Hillary Clinton stands for everything I stand for, she should be able to get through. There are real underlying problems. She has both everything positive going for her and everything negative going for her. Everybody knows who she is. She has 99% name recognition. Everybody has an opinion already about Hillary Clinton. It is going to be very tough for her to persuade people to vote for her who don't already like her, right? She has experience. She projects well as an international candidate, like as an internationalist candidate. Good, strong on foreign policy, all of those things. She's got access to all of the top party fundraisers, logistical networks underneath her. And she's done a very smart thing. She's gone around to all of the individual state parties, which in the Democratic Party have been traditionally very weak. They don't have any money. So she has said to them, I'm going to go to New Hampshire and Iowa and Ohio and South Carolina, and I will put on a fundraiser for your local state party. I don't want any of the money. It can be for you, right? Think about what that does. In contentious states, it makes the state party, at worst, shut up, right? At best, they come out and support her like crazy. Nobody is going to be against her, right? That said, when pollsters ask, what is the first word you think of when I say Hillary Clinton? The number one response is the word liar. That is a real problem. Her trustworthiness numbers, 60% of the country does not think that she is trustworthy. That is a real substantial problem. When she was the Secretary of State, she had a 66% favorability rating because she was not political. Since she's gotten into the race a couple months ago, it has dropped from 66 to 41%. That is a 25% drop in a couple months. That is a real problem. This email issue, I think the word email is highlighted there, with which I'm sure most of you are familiar, is a substantial problem because she set up her own private email server to try and direct State Department traffic into her own server, right? I have a good friend who conducted focus groups with Democratic Party supporters in Colorado, a swing state. And they said things like, well, I wish I could have my own email server, do whatever I want. I wish the rules didn't apply to me like they don't apply to Hillary Clinton. You know, she's been in the public eye for 25 years. It's been rough. I get it. You know, she's been at, you know, in the White House for 8 years. She's run for president once already. She was, you know, Secretary of State. The media, she has a horrible relationship with the media. She fundamentally does not trust them. She thinks that they are all out to get her. Fair enough, right? Hillary Clinton also has a fundamental challenge being a normal person because of it. She is so protected. I will give you the following example. She announced for president. She then said that she was going to get in a van and they were going to drive to Iowa where she was going to earn people's votes, right? In the press conference, she made mention to a reporter that she has not driven a car since 1996. That's a problem. They drive out to Iowa. They stop along the way at a Mexican fast food restaurant. She goes in to buy the tacos. She's wearing huge sunglasses, right? Any one of these Republicans who was running or anybody else would shake everybody's hand in the restaurant. She went in, paid for the tacos, went back out to the van. The two workers looked at each other and said, was that Hillary Clinton? They went and checked the security videotape and they're like, my God, it was Hillary Clinton. They sent it to a reporter, right? That's not normal. Then she arrives in Iowa and says that they're putting together a meeting of normal people that they're going to talk to about politics and about their issues, right? At the meeting was the state head of the Democratic Iowa State Democratic Party, a gay and lesbian local leader and activist, the president of the College Democrats, and like two or three other people who were very involved in the Democratic Party. It's like that. That's not how this is done, right? They have a fundamental inability to be normal people. It is going to be very, very, very difficult for Hillary Clinton to rebrand herself over the course of this election. She is going to be really challenged by Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, who hopefully we can see here in a second. She can probably survive, but at the end of the day, it's not going to be easy just because she controls all the money, right? Ryan Liz is a journalist, and he put up this tweet when all of a sudden Joe Biden was, you know, apparently considering, right? And he says, you know, what is the case for Biden over Hillary Clinton? She doesn't have any of these things. He doesn't have any of these things. Joe Biden is has been elected to the Senate from Delaware, which is a small state in the Northeast, for his entire adult life. He's never had to worry about re-election. He's run for president twice in 1988 and 2008. Both times it was a complete disaster. He plagiarized a speech from Neil Kinnock in 1988, right? Like, that's really bad. He has never had to build a national network of operatives and of fundraisers to support a true national campaign. And now he's late, right? There is not a compelling case for a Joe Biden to become the nominee. That said, you know, he's a cool guy. If crazy Bernie Sanders gets close, I think that there is a pathway for Joe Biden to become the nominee. It's the same story as on the Republican side. Hillary Clinton has real problems. There's some scandal. Everybody freaks out and they say, oh my God, can't be this guy. Like, Bernie Sanders, I probably agree with him on most of the stuff that he says, right? I'm actually to the left of Bernie Sanders when it comes to gun control. He's from a rural state where there are lots of hunters, and so he has kind of a mixed record on gun control, right? But he talks about the middle class and healthcare and all of the sort of middle class problems that the Democratic Party forgets quite often, right? But at the end of the day, this is not the face of the Democratic nominee, right? He seems like an angry guy from Brooklyn who's masquerading as a Democrat. Like, he is not even a member of the Democratic Party. He is a socialist. He is a member of the Socialist Party. The Democratic establishment will not allow him to become the nominee. I almost guarantee it. Like, again, I will eat this iPhone if Bernie Sanders ends up as the nominee. So, you know, that's... I could try and play a Hillary video, but I'm worried my computer will crash, so we can or can't, or maybe we can at the end. But basically, Hillary Clinton will very probably be the nominee. There's a pathway for Joe Biden, and Bernie Sanders sort of has to threaten her in order to be it. So,
got orders here to be brief. So anyway, I was actually skeptical about Hillary's chances in 2008, and I have not become more convinced. And I can add to some other negatives that you did not mention. We haven't said age, and okay, maybe it isn't a problem, but I can't imagine that it's not. Somebody who is going to turn 67 just before the next election, no, 68. Mm-hmm. And then a job you want for 8 years. Anyway, and then there are lots of people who really hate Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Really
My
hate.
My mother is one of them. She voted for Obama twice and said she would never vote for Hillary Clinton.
No, and my now deceased mother-in-law, same story. There was really no reason why you would hate Hillary, but she did, with a vengeance. And also, I mean, for what is a feminist, and are American women interested in the kind of women's issues that we are used to hear, like child paid child leave and those things? We don't know that. I mean, if she's going to run on those things, we don't know if that's going to be a winner. And well, as I said, I have many more. Just one thing. I mean, as you said, she's been in the public eye for 25 years. She's been in the White House. She's been in the Senate. She's been the Secretary of State. And still, there's been stories about how many advisors, how many meetings she's had with these advisors. And then you say,
all of whom hate each other and will probably stab each other in the back.
Yeah, and also, doesn't she know what she stands for? And if she doesn't know why she wants to run for president and what the big issues are going to be in a year, how is she going to find that out?
Yeah.
If politics is about wanting something, as the famous Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme said, politics is will. And what is her? What does she want?
No, she doesn't have a great story.
No. So, did you want to give the people a chance to ask questions?
Okay. When I saw the list of the audience, I understood that there will be a lot of interest for asking questions. So, Alice, and please, please give us your name and short questions. No long stories.
I'm the only one who's given long stories.
Ellis Wallner, ex-American. there are many things I'd want to comment on, but the only thing I'll take up is what you haven't discussed at all. It's actually the mechanics of the presidential election.
Sure.
How much it's been rigged by reducing the rights to vote in various states.
Sure.
That convicts and ex-convicts can't vote many places, et cetera, et cetera. It's so rigged that it'll make it very, very difficult for a Democratic candidate to win. The other thing is the Congress. 90% of representatives automatically get reelected. It's very difficult to change the composition of the House of Representatives. Same thing with the Senate, where only a third are up for election.
Yeah, very briefly, I would just say that the... Should I answer or collect a couple questions? The Senate election actually sets up quite well for Democrats this year, so it's possible. Yes, there are a bunch of horrible voting rights legislation moving through various state houses. North Carolina is probably the best known, where they're trying to do things like force people to provide their driver's license or some sort of identification before they vote, which is, on the surface, the argument for it is, oh, it's easy, everybody has a driver's license. Well, everybody doesn't have a driver's license, and the very act of making somebody to register to vote reduces voter participation by about 10%, right? So you're automatically reducing the pool just because people are forced to vote. Then if you're making them do a separate step of actually having to provide identification, that's going to reduce it further. And so you have old people, senior citizens, young people, who just don't have, who don't have easy access or have lost their birth certificate or something, that's very difficult. And it's really horrible. And a lot of Republicans are seeing the demographic shifts within all of these states. And rather than fighting it on issues or making a better case or hating Latinos a little bit less, what they're doing is trying to make it harder to vote. And that's a horrible thing.
Yeah, and they seem to have succeeded too. But anyway, the other thing that's going to be very important next year will be voter participation, right? And Democrats don't seem to have that great candidates in some of the states for the congressional elections. And then obviously the big challenge for Hillary Clinton will also be the enthusiasm level among African American voters.
Yeah, that's right.
Since they were out in force in 2008 and almost as much in 2012.
Yeah, that said, the one other thing to mention is that the composition of the electorate is very different in congressional years like 2014 and presidential years. Turnout is generally higher. The Democratic Party does a better job of getting minority voters out, people who don't vote quite as often. So it will be, we are not setting up for another Republican landslide because the electorate will change.
Yeah, and then it's also this fact that the Democratic vote is less, is worth less, like in New York City or California. So they have more voters, Democrats, but they don't still lose Congress.
I'm Linnea Sandstrom-Lang. I actually used to work for a super PAC in Illinois.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. that was more on the Democratic side, even though it was nonpartisan. So I guess my question is, because Barack Obama was famous for not actually taking money from PACs at all, and Bernie Sanders isn't doing the same, is it really possible, because Hillary Clinton has gotten a lot of flack for this as well, is it really possible to be a credible Democratic candidate for standing for presidential election without taking that big money if you have money crashing in from the Republican side?
Sure. The short answer is no. I mean, to be clear, Barack Obama did have several super PACs supporting him, the most notable of which is called Priorities USA. Traditionally, they raise less money than the Republicans do, only because most mega donors are somehow slightly less philosophically enthusiastic about super PACs on the Democratic side than they are on the Republican side. But as I've actually written in this book, basically the theory of the case is if we live in a world where the Supreme Court has said that money in politics is not going to be limited, I'm in favor of blowing off the limits to the candidates. If you're going to give as much money as possible, give it all straight to the candidates, because at least at a very minimum level, there is accountability. If a super PAC says something nasty and a lie that's horrible, they can just close up shop and disappear the next day. The candidate has to say, I support this message. They have to be attached to it. So if we're going to live in that world, let's just give all the money to the people who are really going to spend it.
A super PAC advertising probably also adds to the general hatred of politicians too,
sure,
because they're really negative and nasty.
Hey, my name is Alex. I actually just moved here from Chicago with my wife, who just asked the question. And I worked for Rahm in Chicago for his reelection. And my question is actually kind of a follow-up on that. What about, or maybe you both have comments on the currency of this idea of not just eliminating the limits for candidate committees, but also eliminating the limits for party committees and having party committees have more power? Because you talked about the problem with the RNC, for example, not being able to exert control in the individual states, and maybe you have some comments on that.
I mean, the individual limit for a party committee now is somewhere in the neighborhood of $35,000 to $40,000, right? The Supreme Court just passed or just had a ruling in the McCutcheon case where they removed the. There was never there was a limit on how much you could give to a party committee, and there was a limit on how much you could give to a candidate, but there was also a limit to how much you could give in total to every candidate as an individual. Does that make sense? Like the cap, I think, was $55,000 that I could distribute however I wanted, right? The McCutcheon case just removed that. And so donors' favorite excuse was, I've just capped out. I can't give any more money. But now they don't have that excuse anymore. So, I mean, you could say, sure, maybe there's some use in capping money that's given directly to the party committees, but I don't know that that's going to change very much,
I just meant remove the caps.
Oh, sure. No. You could remove the caps, but that would probably be helpful in decreasing the role of the super PAC. But the party committees are more anonymous than a candidate, So you're really playing at the margins one way or the other.
Go on next.
I don't know if there is any more questions. Then, yes, please.
Your name? My name is Hormas Kapadia. I moved to Sweden in 1968, but I've been following the American elections since 1960.
Mm-hmm.
In India, Kennedy was our real hero.
Sure.
And of course, after that, what happened. My question is to you. why not Joe Biden? I think he's got the experience to lead the country. He's got a lot of knowledge, and he'd be a perfect, reasonable candidate.
Sure. I think all of those things are correct. The argument against Joe Biden is on logistics, that he's never had to build the national network of people to support him. That, like, the world we live in now with donors principally donors and operatives around the country to support him, he's just never cultivated that. So it's easier now that he's the vice president and could potentially come in and say, yeah, hey, I'm running too. But Hillary Clinton has vacuumed up. One of Hillary Clinton's biggest strong points is that she scared the entire party into working for her, right? So there are going to be very few people who are going to be eager to jump ship away from Hillary and try and work for the Biden campaign, which at this stage in the race would be difficult to get to the nomination. So it's more of a, it's not a leadership issue, it's not an experience issue, it's not a quality of the candidate issue, it's a mechanics of politics issue.
Plus, he did try twice before. He didn't get that far. And also, he has a tendency to maybe say little clumsy things. He's a bit of a joke in some circles, I think you could say. Unfortunately.
Hi, I'm Leonard Borge. About 4 years ago, when Obama was up for re-election, we had a similar meeting here at the arena. And I think a colleague of yours said, I can guarantee you that Obama will win. Because of demographics, the Hispanics, the black vote, the gays and lesbians, et cetera, et cetera. And the way the demographics are developing makes that certain. Now, what about that argument now? Is it still valid that structurally you will have a stronger base for the Democrats? So what can defeat that?
We collect another question, and then we can answer both the ending of this.
Okay, I'm Jens Magnusson from SCB, and it was actually very much along the same line. And just tagging on that, of course the demographic is very well known to the Republicans as well. And certainly the Hispanic community is quite often family values and quite religious and could be potential Republican voters. What does the party do when Donald Trump calls all Mexican rapists?
The party didn't do a whole lot because they're nervous he might end up being their nominee. But on the demographic issue, yes, things are definitely trending towards the progressive way. When Donald Trump does things like say Mexicans are rapists, that pulls the entire party to the right. I think the numbers are in 2004, George Bush had a goal of winning 40% of Latino voters, right? Which he did. By the time we got to 2008, Barack Obama had won 65%. So John McCain only won like 35% of Latinos. 2012, it was a 70-30 split. It would not surprise me if this year it is 90-10, right? It wouldn't. Also, demographically, for younger voters under the age of about 30, one of the old adages in American politics is once you vote twice for the same party, you're locked in for a generation, right? All of these young people have voted for Barack Obama twice by basically a 2/3 margin, right? They're probably going to continue to vote Democrat for the next 25 or 30 years until they become rich and want tax cuts. Right? So that's why. So the trend's set up well. Also, the pollsters will tell you the national numbers are so tight. Like, it drove me bonkers 2 days before the election last year. Actually, I think it was on the bus tour we did with the Arena Group. I was giving sort of a similar election discussion like this on the bus, and I said, everybody raise your hand who thinks the election is too close to call. And like everybody raised their hand, and I said, that's completely wrong. Obama is certainly going to win, because when you get into the individual states, the national number doesn't matter. Yeah, he's going to win like nationally, he's going to win 50.4% of the vote or whatever it is, which he did. He won by a couple million votes, right? Within the states, the turnout model and the demographics and all of that stuff just is going the Democrats' way. And so the one thing that I would comment and caution on is, which may change this election, Democrats have had a much better turnout machine. They've targeted voters better. They've gotten them to go to the polls much better. That's going to change. The Republicans cannot sit back and take it anymore. They have to innovate and they have to catch up. So my guess is you'll start seeing that more this election.
Well, just a couple of small points. One is that the voter participation rate among Latinos is lower than in other groups.
Yep.
So that will be a challenge for both parties to get them to vote. And then obviously it's the states, right? I mean, we know the swing states, the 9, 10 or whatever. So it may be that there will be a Democratic loss anyway because of the number of the electoral votes. So, but anyway, what can happen would be, I mean, I'm on your John Kasich trip. I actually believed in Scott Walker until he came up on the bigger stage.
Yeah.
But I mean, Kasich has something. It's a swing state, often trending Democratic, and he isn't as ideologically pure as maybe... Yeah.
He's a moderate.
Yeah, and he comes across as a nice guy. But if it's Hillary against Jeb Bush, I think it's going to be a very sad election year.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
On that happy note.
Okay, thank you very much. Jim and Corin,
thank you.
Give them an applause.